And we just, you know, started breaking some ground in the first chapter. And let's take on another point, which really I'll put out as a question. And that's chapter 1, verse, looks like 9 and 10, I have my notes. And the person will say, look, there's a certain matter that a person will say, look, it's new. But he says, he answers this in the same verse, and he says, no, this already happened for many generations prior. That were before us. So this is bespeaking of the person's emotion to want to say, hey, there's something new over here. I remember years ago Rabbi Chaid mentioned the sentiment that the motion of modernity, to be modern, to have something in our generation that previous generations didn't have. So when a person will say, hey, look, there's something new, like they made new technology, they made new ground, you know, all the electronic devices, it's propelled by a certain emotion and it satisfies that's the very same emotion that the generation and you know, of course, which is made up of individuals, that people are looking to substantiate their worth. Evidently, underlying this need to say we're modern is ego, primarily, that you want to stand out. But this certain, it's interesting how it's a certain emotion of the generation that you attach to your time. And it seems to be a psychological principle. It's not merely like, you know, there's many things you can do during your day that are mundane. It doesn't matter whether you buy a red pair of pants or a blue pair of pants. That's not a significant event. It's not a significant phenomenon. Here, King Solomon, when we talked about this, that he's laying the groundwork of how the human psyche works. What are the primary principles, the fundamental notions or feelings that a person operates on. And we talked about immortality and ambition and success and ego, fame, honor. These are all the most primary, and he's lining this one up as well. All right, and he says that in 9 and 10. What had already existed, that's what's going to exist in the future. And also what is mashanasa, what is done, that is what is going to be done. There's nothing under the sun. So you see that he attacks two areas, objects and events. Because that is what exists. If you notice also in the plagues, so they were grouped into three sets of three, the 10 plagues in Egypt. The last one, like Rabbi Chaid explained, was the death of the firstborns. That was merely to put an end to the culture which is promulgated and proliferated by the firstborns. They were the ones that the society looked up to and listened to. So if they were annihilated, you wouldn't have those leaders that would you know, carry Egyptian culture into the next generation. So that was a separate reason for the death of the firstborns. But the previous nine are really grouped. And I'm not sure, I think it's one of the rabbis in the Rabbi Lezer, Rabbi Kiva, I don't have the Haggadah in front of me, but one of them said, he gave an acronym for the plagues. So what is it, just an easy mnemonic? It's only 10 plagues, it's not hard to remember. An acronym I could see for something which is, you know, a little bit more lengthy. So what's his idea of giving an acronym for the, he took the first letter of each of the plagues and he spelled out an acronym that was three letters, then three letters, then four letters. So I don't recall which rabbi said this, but it's a very good idea. And that is that when God was bringing the plagues to the Egyptians, it wasn't just to free the Jews. It was to give them numerous opportunities to recognize that their idolatry was false. And the way this is done, and also it was a question I never had an answer to, but I inclined towards, a certain approach, meaning were the 10 plagues absolute? Did these 10 plagues have to happen? Meaning, perhaps they were only meted out. Each one of these plagues were given, but it wasn't that there was a plan that these 10 were absolute. These had to be there. There had to be frogs. There had to be grasshoppers. Perhaps it was based on the response and the reaction of Paro and the Egyptians, and due to how they responded to the initial plague, so then the next plague was designed on the heels of that, meaning it was trying to address the specific natures, personalities of Paro and the Egyptians. So for example, the first plague, and we'll get back to the acronym in a second, but the first plague was to destroy the view that the Nile River was their god. It doesn't rain in Egypt, and they depend on the rise of the Nile at certain periods to irrigate the land. So they would have trenches that would channel the Nile's water. When it rose at a certain point, it would fill the trenches, and or maybe they kept the trenches very low that the Nile was constantly feeding throughout all the land. So you see that they were very dependent upon it, but these were mystical people, and since this was their life source, they viewed it as a god. And you see Paro, even in his dream, where he has the seven cows, that Olos Mini are there, they came out of the river, so he was standing over the Nile River. Rabbi Chait said very sharp point. You see in his dream, Paro looked at himself as above the Nile, meaning he was even greater in his own mind than the god of Egypt. Nonetheless, it was the god of Egypt. It was something that they had to be rid of. So therefore, the first plague was to turn it into blood. The Nile River is helpless. So this is something which Paro's response was that he walked away, and even the Egyptians were able to mimic this. Sajigon says they had some red-colored liquids that they would throw into, surreptitiously. They would put it into some water here and there when Paro wasn't looking, and they said, yeah, we could do this also. But it wasn't real blood. It was only colored dyes, as Sajigon says. Same thing with the frogs. When they were able to mimic that, they threw some chemicals into the water that the frogs were allergic to. So they fled from the Nile in an attempt to escape something which was bothersome. And it looked like they were causing a plague of frog also. They couldn't, however, do the next plague of lice. And they blame it on the finger of God, the astrologer says. They didn't want to take blame. The bottom line is they couldn't do it because lice are too small to control with your fingers. There's only a certain level of control that the human hand has. But what happened? When Paro saw the blood, he saw the river turn to blood, so it said it turned and he went to his house. So why is the Torah telling us that he turned away and he went to his house? See, the next plague tells you that. The next plague was frogs. Well, what's significant about that? You look at the verses. The verses say that the frogs filled everywhere, every part of the home. So you see clearly that frogs came on the tail of the Nile, because as a response to Paro's attempt to deny and go back to his home, that's a safe haven. He doesn't have to face the bloody Nile when he's inside of his palace. So he tried to use escapism as a response and as an attempt to deny the miracles, the first miracle. So God sends the next plague, which indicates to me that he wanted to show there's nowhere to hide. So it's a response. Frogs really came as a response to the behavior. You had another one like this also. You had the boils. So the boils, it says that once the boils came upon Egypt, so it says the astrologers couldn't stand before Moses because the boils were on the astrologers and on the Egyptian people. So again, God's giving you a hint in the verse as to how to understand what this purpose of boils is all about. So they state that the Torah states that they couldn't stand before Moses. So I understand it's because the boils were on the astrologers. But what are you telling me that they couldn't stand before the astrologers couldn't stand before Moses because the boils were on the astrologers and on the Egyptians? What's the relevance, the boils being on the Egyptians? If we're only talking about the reason why the astrologers couldn't stand before Moses, we should only talk about their ailment. Right? But it's telling you, it's not a matter of posture that they couldn't stand up. Because boils, first of all, it's on your skin. It's not something which affects your joints, your muscles. So it doesn't affect how you stand or whatever. But it doesn't mean stand in terms of posture. It means stand in terms of presenting themselves in front of Moses. Because if they're the astrologers, they're the magicians, and they could do all these magical tricks, how come they can't get rid of their own boils? So the Torah is telling you that boils now came as an attack on another element of belief that the Egyptian culture had, and that is the belief of the astrologers, that they really had some mysticism. So this shows you that it was not true. They couldn't get rid of their own boils, so what type of magicians are they? That's why it says that they couldn't stand before Moses. Why? Because the boils were on the astrologers and on the Egyptians, meaning it's making an equation. The astrologers were no different than the rest of the Egyptian people. That's why it says the boils were on the astrologers and the Egyptians. To show you, they were no different. The astrologers had the boils and the Egyptian people, the regular people, common people had the boils too. So it's equating the astrologers to the Egyptians. Neither one had powers to get rid of it. So this eliminated, and you don't see the Egyptian astrologers mentioned again after that. You notice that also. Omission in the Torah is just as important as inclusion. So if you see something that's omitted suddenly, it shows you that the effect of the plague was successful. Another one you have like this were the hail. So the hail is coming down, and it's about to come down, and he tells Moses, goes to Paro. And what does he tell him? He tells him that after the hail hit, he tells Paro that the stiff plants were broken by the hail. But the soft plants, the ones that were not yet fully ripe, so they were still flexible, so they did not suffer from the hail. So what's Moses telling Paro about this agricultural report? You see that Moses understood the plague of hail to be representative, a lesson specifically to Paro's obstinance. He's telling Paro, if you're going to be stiff, you're going to break like the hail. So the hail was not only it ruined the crops and it devastated Egypt. And then you see that the locusts came after that and they consumed everything that was left. So now it was attacking them in terms of their sustenance. But there were underlying lessons too, even in the design of the plagues. So that's why I say that not necessarily were all the plagues mapped out. There could have been some had to be, like the sustenance, the hail, or it could have been some were not, like the frogs, that they were a response to the Paro. But in either case, this acronym was to teach that God's control is over all areas of the universe. So what are the first three? And they're in groups of three. The first three, the plagues, they attacked miracles. There were miracles that attacked the soil, the sand, and the Nile River, both elements of the earth. Right? The earth is made up of water and of soil. That pretty much comprises everything. Everything comes from that. So God shows control over the water with the Nile River and with the frogs, and he also shows control over the sand by turning the sand into lice. So that takes care of that. The last three within the universe have to do with not the earth, but the heavens. Darkness, locusts that are blown in by the wind, hail that comes from the heavens. So that shows that God is not only in control of the earth's substance, but God's control, he's in control of the heavens too. So everything on the earth, and everything in the earth, and everything in the heavens. And the only thing left are not objects alone. I mean, that covers now all substances. The substance of the earth and the substance of everything above the earth. That's it. That covers everything. The only thing left is our events. I mean, God controls everything that was created, and also not only the objects that he created, but also the behavior of things he can control. That's the mixture of the animals, and the death of the animals, and the boils. So those you have sandwiched right in between, to show exactly like Koheles is saying over here, in our verse, everything which has happened, that is everything that will be, that is what was already, meaning objects. And everything that will be done, that's events. Right? So, again, he says in verse 9, that which was, that is what will be. Meaning there's nothing new in terms of substances, objects of creation. And also not only objects, but also events. That which was done, that's what will be done. There's nothing new. Man can't do anything new. He's looking for it. But you see, there's a parallel that's showing you that in terms of control of everything. So that has to do with both the object's creation and the behavior. And you have one more example that teaches this. And that's actually what took place last week. You had a Sabbath, which was also the new moon. So we have a special additional prayer on the Sabbath new moon. And that prayer starts off with the words, "You created the world from a long time ago." Now, why do we say that on the Sabbath new moon? See, because Sabbath alone, that is, it recalls the act of creation. That's what Sabbath is. God rested after creating all the objects. New moon now shows the behavior is now repeating. The cycle of the moon is repeating. It's starting over again. It's new. It's a new cycle. But it's the behavior. That's the importance of the new month. That we again testify to God's control, but now it's in terms of the behavior of the universe. But when the behavior, which is the new moon, that celebration coincides with Sabbath, so now there's a new prayer that the rabbis instituted in order to tell you that what you're seeing now are both systems, and it's a compound testament to the fact that God is not only the creator of everything, but that he's control of the behavior of everything. So there's the objects, and then there's the laws, the events, or the behavior of how the world operates. So you see a number of cases where these themes are primary and they're reiterated. And the rabbis saw this and they pulled this out. And you see how King Solomon talks about it over here in Koheles, and how God used this in terms of the plagues to demonstrate again that your gods are false. And what's the proof? God showed his complete control over all substances of creation, that's the earth and the heavens above, and he also showed control over all events. And again, you have that the Sabbath and the new moon. So you see these themes are reiterated because they are primary, they're central. And when you see it a number of times, it's impressive because you know that they're so essential. And once you hear it, you understand that these are very, very broad principles, and you know what man really has to understand. So that's where God came from in terms of why he's using these specific groups of plagues, and that's why Rabbi Lezer made this acronym. And he said the first three are these letters, the next three are these letters, and the next three are these letters, to show you they were grouped into three, that each group of plagues was addressing another aspect. It was showing the Egyptians, whoever would listen, that God's control is categorical. So it wasn't just a means to remember the plagues. Okay. Any questions? Yeah, it is. Okay. But you see this emotion that people want to say there's something new. So King Solomon says, there is some. He says in 110, a person is going to say, there's something new. Nope. That already happened. Many times over. But you see the people are looking for that, because they're looking to substantiate their worth. So if that's where the person is going, he's going to find dissatisfaction, frustration, and he won't really be able to substantiate it in reality. Do you think that there's something new? It's really not. No matter what it is, maybe you have, you know, more advanced electronics or things of that nature, but what he's trying to say is if you boil down all these things, what is it really? You make a great new car, it's fast, it's this and that. Yeah, well, back then you had people that had races. So before they had, you know, hundreds of years ago, before there were cars, 150 years ago even, before you had cars, so you still had the concept of somebody being faster. This is nothing new. So now you're doing it in a car. But you had the horse races. You had the exact same emotion. Or you're looking for power, that this truck can haul a certain load. Well, you had that too. I remember when I was a kid watching movies, and there was one movie where there was a man who was showing how strong his horse was, and he tied up a tree trunk to the harness of the horse, and the horse was able to pull it, and it was like an amazingly strong horse. You see there, again, that emotion was decades ago. So all these different emotions there, they're primary. There's nothing which changes in man. That's why you're not going to find something new. Any emotion that you think you're satisfying today, any new step that you're making that you get excited about, why are you getting excited about it? The excitement really comes from a lie to yourself that this is something which is unparalleled. So how does King Solomon, one of the wisest men ever, or the wisest man next to Moses, how does he address this emotion? Are you looking for something new? He tells you, no, it already existed many times over, generations before. You just have to find which emotion you're trying to dress up, and you think it's a new thing. People fool themselves. They fool themselves. So anything you can really name that you think is new. So, there were inventions. You have iPads. You have the most advanced technology today, and you think that that's now... that's it. That puts us at the forefront of everybody. Well, next generation, they may have something which is 10 times better. And in the past, you had Eli Whitney. He made the cotton gin. And other people who made Washington Carver and other inventors. You had inventors all the way back in time, the abacus. So there, again, you have examples of how people thought that... I'm not saying that these inventors thought... this, they had a corrupt emotion, but you see that that's there. The emotion to invent, to be making something new, whether it's promoted by technology or economic needs or just curiosity, which is probably the most admirable reason to invent something. You're just curious about how the world works. That's really interesting the creator, hopefully. So anything he's trying to show you that, but there is that emotion. There is that underlying need. We have to make a mark. We're modern. And King Solomon says, no, it's already been there. Anything that you're trying to do, because man hasn't changed. So anything you're going to attempt to do to satisfy a certain emotion, that emotion is ancient as man. And that's important. And you see he even goes further with this very emotion in the next verse where he says, there's not going to be any remembrance to the first ones, first people, and not to anybody later on. Right? Meaning the later on people that will be in the future. Future generations, they're not going to be remembered either. There will not be to them any remembrance with those who will be at the latter end. What is he addressing now? See, the person is still looking for that satisfaction, that importance. So now he looks for it post-mortem, which is foolish, because he's not going to be around to enjoy people talking about how great he is. So he imagines, well, you know, maybe I'll leave over something and I'll make my mark then, and people will remember me. So that's a foolish thing, because that doesn't affect you in any way. And in fact, you won't be remembered. I mean, who today talks about somebody from 200 years ago? People today are just there. They have their family, their friends, things that are in current events in the news. You see clearly. But King Solomon is telling you that's another emotion you may try to satisfy. So it's just to reiterate what we had discussed on that.
That's a very interesting point, Rabbi.
Yeah. One second. This is a plane going overhead. I got the window open. Yeah, go ahead. Right, but the people in the past generation, there's no remembrance of them, so it's a foolishness for a person to say, today I'll do something, and I'll have some sort of a stake in the future. People remember me, I'll go down in history. That's a foolish thing to say, I'll go down in history. As if it's going to benefit you somehow when you're already gone. And the fact is, you're not even remembered. Even the greatest people. I mean, how often is somebody mentioning even the recent... Einstein, I mean, that maybe is more, but George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, it's very rare that, unless you're in, the kids are studying that in school as a topic, that's something which is part of, a person's daily discourse. That's just not there. But it's the emotion that King Solomon is trying to show you, that all these different, he just wants to show you that this is how the human being works, these are the things that a person is going after, and he has to lay this down at the beginning of his book, in order that when he talks through the rest of his book and he advises us, that we can appreciate where he's coming from. Because now we know the main principles that a human being operates on, the different areas he's trying to strive for. But without having that appreciation, it would be difficult to understand why he would suggest this and not suggest that. It's only once you understand, as a doctor can only prescribe medication or procedure after years of studying the body. Same thing over here. A person can only appreciate King Solomon's advice in terms of human happiness once he understands the human psyche, once he understands the main components. And then he fleshes it out in all the succeeding chapters. Yeah. Okay. All right, so that took care of novelty. All right, and then the person's fame, post-mortem. We talked also about last week, we covered the fact that everything that he criticizes is under the sun, right? Meaning a person's only assessing things based on the earthly existence, so then if that's alone where he's looking for his value, so then it will not satisfy him. It won't be worth anything. Okay. And he says that twice. All right? In chapter, first chapter, verses 13 and 14, you see, he talks about under the sun twice. And he's ridiculing it. All right. Yep.
Rabbi, is it true that when something is repeated a second time, it must be more emphatic?
You're breaking up. Can you say that again, please? Yeah, for sure. Yes, and if a lot of references to it are made, repetition, or if just a lot of space in the Torah is given to something, is because it's very important too. We had actually talked about that, I'm not sure, in one of these classes, but the Torah has a question why it says the whole story of Eliezer when he went to find Abraham has sent Eliezer, his servant, to go find a wife for Isaac. And the Torah takes up such tremendous amount of verses with that story and repeats over. It tells what happened at the well, and he found her at the well, and the whole discussion, and then they go back to the house, and he repeats the whole thing over and over again, and Rashi asks the question, why is it that this servant of Abraham his words are taking up so much space in the Torah, and you have many mitzvahs of the Torah that are maybe mentioned just once. So how, it's like an imbalance. It's giving so much more weight to the mundane speech of Eliezer as opposed to God's actual commands. That's a very powerful question. So he says that the to teach you that the mundane speech of the servants of the patriarchs is more beloved to God than the Torah of their children. The mundane speech of the servants of the forefathers is more precious to God than the Torah of their descendants. What's the equation? So the point is what's it doing? You have to think about it. It's equating two things. It's equating the speech versus the commandments, and it's equating the servants of the patriarchs to the future Jewish people. So you see, there's two things that's being equated. It's telling you that the mundane speech of the servants of the patriarchs is more beloved to God than the Torah of the descendants of Abraham. So what I believe the message is that what's the equation here? That the patriarchs and their servants, they attached themselves to God without any real commands. Yes, it's true there were seven Noahide laws, but they lived in a certain way with such perfection, thinking out for themselves what's the right way to approach God. And they did it without a coercion, without an obligation. Whereas the Jews of the future, they had to take a Torah, they had to accept it. It was given to them. That's why they're following it. And to the point that even the mundane speech, and you see that how Eliezer worked, that even that is something which is more beloved to God than the Torah of the future generation, because the mundane speech really was an expression of the natural perfection they arrived at even without a Torah system. And that expresses a higher level. That's what God means, that it's more beloved to him. That's a higher level of human being. That's a higher level of human being, that without even the Torah system, that these people arrived at such a level of life and perfection that even their servant's speech is more beloved to God, because even that carried with it an intelligence and approach to life that they did without a coercion. So you see that the Torah goes out of the way, just like you mentioned before, that when you repeat something in the Torah, so that's emphasizing it, it's trying to show the importance, not only repetition, but also when there's a giant amount of verses that are taken up for this story of Eliezer, that's to show you also the importance. And that's exactly what Rashi is pointing at.
Yeah. Is it true that you get more reward for doing a mitzvah because you're told to do it than because you do it on your own from common sense? How our forefathers didn't have the Torah yet, but yet they were like dealing with Hashem directly.
That's true. Rabbi Chayin actually expressed that. And it doesn't mean that it's greater in every respect. When it says, because there is the rabbis have a statement, that greater is one who is commanded than a person who is not commanded. Meaning two people do the same command. But one's commanded, let's say a Jew, and another person's not commanded, meaning Noahide. So the Jew is getting more reward, or it's greater in some way. So it's not necessarily more reward. I'm wrong to say that. It's greater in some measure. But Rabbi Chayin explained, it's because it's greater because the Jew has to now overcome the tendency to rebel. When you're commanded, now there's a natural rebelliousness when you are now being told to do something. So you have to overcome that, which a person who just does it without the command, he didn't have to overcome that. So the Jew, who now is commanded in something and he overcomes that resistance, he now perfected another part of his personality, whereas another person didn't have that. So that's what it means greater. In some respect, it's greater. It doesn't mean that a Jew today is greater than the patriarchs who weren't commanded. It can mean in a certain level, a certain aspect of greater. It doesn't mean absolutely greater.
I used to think that I had to think somehow that when somebody does something out of the goodness of their heart, it's bigger mitzvah than if it's something, oh, it's written. Somehow think of it that way, because people who do things good heart. They do things with love for their fellow man. It isn't because they command them to do it, but because they do it, because they care.
Well, that could also be a certain, you have to understand that there's a lot of motivation behind a person's actions. And sometimes a person does something because they want the applause of others, they're doing it for the self-image. So there's a lot of motivating things. And, you know, a lot, and that happens many times. People are altruistic there, or people can be giving money because they want to be celebrated with fame at a dinner. So that's a motivating thing. If they wouldn't be celebrated at the dinner, would they give their money privately? That's a real test. So it's hard to really say that, but if a person's, see, you have to look at the person who's in, who's following because he realizes that this is something which is God's will, no other purpose. He's not looking for any other type of celebration, fame, success monetarily. God's really the only one that can make that assessment. Right? Okay. Okay, so now, let's just see. Right, so maybe we'll wrap it up here. Now, for the next 2 weeks, I'm going to be taking off of Passover. I mean, the next Sunday is a holiday, so it can't be. But the Sunday after Passover, I'm also not going to be doing a class. So we'll resume. Today is the 1st, so that's the 22nd. So we'll resume on the 22nd. Jim, you say something?
No.
Okay. But that doesn't mean we don't have to have contact if there's questions that come up or issues and so on. By the way, Jim, how did it go with the Noahide site and the posting, the updated one that I sent you?
Nobody responded. Nobody had anything to say. So nothing.
Did they post it?
I posted it on the Noahide Nation's Yahoo page. Because I didn't see any way for me to post it. If you'd like, I can ask Ray to post it on their front page.
And it's up to them. I wouldn't, you know, put it in their face. I mean, if you put it in a way where everybody involved knows where it is, that's sufficient. No, there was, let them know there's a response. Make sure that they are aware of it, and they should, correct this behavior, and that's it. They say, a word to the wise is sufficient. So, if a person's wise, they'll get it. If they're not wise, you could talk to your blue in the face. So let's just hope that it's something which they hear. And I saw that there was some resistance you sent me. So, we did what we had to do. All right. So we wish everybody a great week. And again, like I said, just because we're not going to have the class doesn't mean we can't be in touch if anything comes up. All right?
Thank you. Thank you. Happy Passover, everybody.
Okay, everybody.
Thank you.
Okay.
Be well.
Thank you, everybody.
Bye.